Welcome back to HealthLink on Air, produced each week by Upstate Medical University and University Hospital. Linda Cohen along with you. Well, this year marks the 100th anniversary of the legendary, though somewhat ill-fated expedition to the South Pole, led by Royal Navy officer and explorer Robert Falcon Scott. Though the expedition was inaugurated with much enthusiasm and optimism, ultimately, leader Scott and four others died during the return journey from the South Pole to the expedition's base camp at Camp Evans. However, it was during this British Antarctic expedition of 1910 to 1913 that many important public health issues regarding exposure to cold temperatures and cold weather injury were revealed and identified. Joining this morning to fill us in on these important public health discoveries is Dr. Timothy Dye, adjunct professor of public health and preventive medicine at Upstate Medical University and the former director of the Center for Research and Evaluation at Upstate, and associate dean for research and professor of public health in the Falk College of Sport and Human Dynamics at Syracuse University. Dr. Stye has studied this expedition and many others, and recently completed a documentary about the health and culture of this historic event. Welcome, Dr. Dye. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So, what does it mean to study, first of all, what does it mean to study the health and culture of an expedition?
Well, it's an interesting concept. My background is in anthropology and in medical epidemiology, and we tend to study social factors that are related to health. And my interest is in extreme environments and isolated communities. And one of the most isolated communities you could study are people who work in Antarctica. So we sort of developed an approach where we would look at some of the social factors that might influence health and how people take care of themselves in an extreme environment.
Can you give me an example of what that might be? What social factor, for example?
Sure. Well, actually, we didn't know when we went in. So part of the work, it's like classic Margaret Mead anthropology. We went into Antarctica with a grant from the National Science Foundation and lived in Antarctica and worked there for parts of the season for three consecutive years.
Wow.
So we learned about the culture and we learned what the factors were. And they're different factors than you'd find in America, which is where most of the workers are from. And the American base in Antarctica, most of the workers would be from the United States. But the culture and the society shifts when you're in Antarctica.
How so?
Well, there are probably 1,200 people who work there in the peak of the summer season, which is our winter, but their summer. And it's like a workplace in some ways. It's a community that's devoted to scientific support exploration, but really mostly scientific supports from the National Science Foundation. And there are many different components of the community that come together and interact. And when someone gets injured or hurt in a remote environment like that, it's a severe problem. It could be a problem for that person. If you break an arm in Syracuse, you go to the hospital and you get it fixed. If you break an arm in Antarctica, your whole work site could be shut down and you could be in some serious trouble. So we wanted to see what kinds of factors might be related to the risks that people would take and the safety precautions that people would use to prevent injuries. And that kind of backed into this study sort of secondarily into the historical expeditions that occurred 100 years earlier in the same location.
And that was because you hoped to see what challenges they encountered and perhaps how that informed the current ones that you're seeing?
Yeah, exactly. And what was interesting when I was in Antarctica and working there contemporarily in this past few years, you'd see these huts that were used by Captain Scott and the other explorers kind of off in the distance, and
they
you could
were
visit
still
them.
There.
Sure.
Wow.
You could visit, there's still food in the cupboards, and there's still, you know, seals that they ate, the remnants of the seals and horses and things that were still there. Everything was frozen and things are preserved.
That's
so
amazing.
It's sort of this surreal kind of experience. And I was curious after the first season, what sort of social factors did they face in the same environment? Because this is a very extreme environment, obviously, with high winds and high cold and very low humidity, isolation. So after that first year, I got another grant from the National Science Foundation to really delve into the diaries and journals of Captain Scott's expedition. And what was quite unusual about this expedition at the time, there were maybe 30 people who were participating in it. Almost all of them kept personal journals. And most of those journals are now housed at the University of Cambridge in England at the Scott Polar Research Institute. So I took a year sabbatical. I read all the original journals, went to New Zealand, read the new journals that were there. and learned about the culture sort of through reading their journals and their letters home and all of that, including the journals of the people who died on the expedition. Five of those men died after they reached the South Pole and the return journey to their base camp, as you mentioned. So reading about the factors, we could see something about the risks that they took and the social factors and the social pressures that they face that are the exact same pressures that we face now.
That's interesting. So what was illuminating to you about the historical journey, and how did that kind of square up with what you found contemporaneously?
I think there were sort of two related things that were real important in terms of the research that we did there. One is that people don't always they know about safety precautions, but they don't always do what they're supposed to do or use the equipment they're supposed to be using. For example, if you use goggles, it helps prevent snow blindness, something as simple as that, or obviously gloves or covering, something like that. But those can sometimes get in the way of you doing your work, and there may be other reasons why you might not use those goggles for convenience or even social pressure to not use those, because you may be perceived as being weak or something in that sort when you're in a all-male group, you know, this kind of a situation. So people take risks, they get injured, and then they're very reluctant to disclose that they're injured. And when you're in a small group like this, again, contemporarily, if you're in a work team in Antarctica in a remote station and you're injured, you're often not likely to tell your colleagues that you've been injured. You want to keep it hidden because you'd be embarrassed that maybe you didn't follow precautions, or you don't want to be perceived in a certain way, or nowadays you may be sent back. So back then we found the same thing, that people, particularly on this return journey from Antarctica, they would be injured and they wouldn't tell Captain Scott, or they wouldn't disclose it to their colleagues, and they'd keep on and keep on, and they'd get worse and worse and worse, and it would just compound to the degree that this is how all of them ended up dying, is related to their injuries and the disability that came from their injuries, and they were very reluctant to disclose those injuries as they were occurring.
So you're suggesting that perhaps this notion of machismo, or for want of a better term, you know, this kind of rugged individualism and power under any circumstances was their undoing, and you're saying that continues today.
It's a little bit of it. I'd say that's certainly part of the culture that exists. You want to be tough, you want to be hardy, and you want to be able to basically fight the environment that you're in. You're in this extreme environment, and it's sort of a man over environment situation, right?
So that's unchanged. But what I'm curious about is that today we must have learned something, not only from these prior explorers, but clearly science and medical science has advanced in the 100 years. And so what we can offer people in that even extreme environment has got to be different. I mean, even the equipment that's being used has got to be more protective. So with that in mind, have attitudes changed, for example?
It's a good question. And, you know, to be honest, as an anthropologist, the way I answer this question, and in my own work teams when I worked in Antarctica, you don't always follow the precautions that you know would be helpful to follow.
Even today.
And just like we all know from public health generally, you know, these are always situations. We find that men and women do things differently.
Women being more cautious?
Sometimes.
Self-protective.
Yes, in different kinds of ways. But there are things you can put in your boots so that you don't slip. And there are people in Antarctica who are at risk of, you know, pretty severe injuries if they slip. But very few people wear these things on their boots because it's not perceived as cool. You know, it's not perceived as really something you want to be seen. You just are going to be careful, and you're not necessarily going to take on these adaptations in that way.
Were there things that they learned, though, that you learned or that have been learned from something like Scott's expedition that have improved the safety in today's cold weather, you know, to prevent cold weather injuries like frostbite, for example? Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously what you're saying is cultural and personal mandates and attitudes interfere with perhaps following through on a lot of these things. But the fact is we do have more knowledge.
Yeah, exactly. I think probably the biggest thing that's helpful now is the work teams have a sense of really functioning as a team. And it's disrespectful to your colleagues to not take the precautions, because if you get injured and we only have three people on our work team and we're in Antarctica and one of us is down, then we're all going to suffer. So there's a definitely a shift toward coherent, cultural groups, these work teams are very close, and there's more of a social pressure to do what's safe, even if there are other pressures outside of that little group that may be kind of acting against that in some way. But I think having these work teams be much more coherent as a group, also having mixed gendered work teams, having men and women mixed on a work team, tends to have the work team overall be safer, at least from my sort of anecdotal experience around that.
And say more about that, though. So you were saying, do you think women then are more cautious and do take better care in that sense? Or less needing to show their, you know, their tougher side?
I worked with two women in this research, Dr. Nancy Chin, who's an anthropologist, and Dr. Ann Dozier, who's a nurse researcher, both at the University of Rochester. And we even ourselves had different attitudes of how we were going to take care of ourselves and the things that we would do in the conduct of our own research. I'm not sure if they'd say women were more cautious, but what we do know is when you have a mixed gendered team, everybody behaves better in a way of taking care of themselves, paying more attention to how they're behaving, paying more attention to these kinds of issues. I don't know if it's just that women are safer in this environment or if somehow the mix and maybe approximating a sort of a normal group outside of the Antarctic environment, maybe that helps people behave more in a way that would be expected outside of Antarctica.
Well, it's not surprising to me as a woman because, I mean, and you think of family structures, while a father in a normal, typical family might be the protector, for argument's sake, often the mother is the one who's really looking out for all the well-being of everyone within the group. So I think women tend to have that tendency anyway.
And definitely this historic work, you know, there were no women that were part of this historic expedition right. with Captain Scott. And it was certainly an issue that these were a mix of military and civilian men. They had certain expectations of how they were going to behave and a certain coolness and bravado that they had to maintain in terms of how they were going to behave in this environment. And ultimately, the compounding effect of these injuries led to the deaths of Captain Scott and his colleagues. So there was a lot to be learned in there from that kind of an experience.
So have you looked at other expeditions as well as Scott's to see if there are any kind of, you know, kind of universal truths that come out, or is this been the major thrust?
Well, I'd say in the Antarctic, I've certainly become familiar with Shackleton's expedition and some of the other expeditions, although not to the degree that I've become involved in the Scott expedition because I read all of their journals and private letters and things of that sort. But I've seen it in my other research. I've done research in Africa. I've done research in Tibet. These are often isolated places that take us a week to reach. And you can see on these research expeditions some of the same behaviors in terms of having to take extra care in a way that we wouldn't necessarily take care here because we have access to health services. And if something happens here, you can go to the hospital or the doctor and get patched up. But if you're in Africa or if you're in the Himalayas and you're injured, you could be in some serious trouble.
So to sum up, what you think, I think I'm hearing you say is that while the attitudes and the culture might be one of machismo, so to speak, at the same time, there's a competing, very strong force to work together as a team to protect under those kinds of circumstances.
Yes, as long as you have that attitude toward the group. If you have a group that's not working very well and people are individual and they're not acting as a group, then you're going to have those problems. But if the group acts as a group, then that definitely helps improve the safety compliance and the health.
Well, it's so fascinating. Dr. Timothy Dye, adjunct professor of public health and preventive medicine at Upstate Medical University, and also now you're the dean for research and professor of public health at the Falk College of Sport and Human Dynamics at Syracuse University. My God, that's a big mouthful, but thanks so much for coming in. Very interesting research, and hopefully we'll have you back to talk about some other things. We have to take a short break. We're going to be right back. This is Linda Cohen, and HealthLink on Air is still ahead. FM News Radio 106.9 and 570 WSYR.